Hello all, welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, a book of the week style program that covers literary, philosophical, and aesthetic topics. I'm Patrick Barney, and together with my two other hosts, Chris Malmy Malmberg and Hans Berger Berger, we're discussing Lost Memory of Skin, an intriguing and controversial novel by the prolific Russell Banks. This episode, I'm going to offer a trigger warning here at the beginning. Lost Memory of Skin features several characters who are pedophiles who are similar to pedophiles. So if you don't want to hear about stuff that's disturbing in that area, then please stop listening now. By continuing to listen, you are agreeing not to sue us if you get upset by something that we say. So fair warning right now, leave if you don't want to hear about pedophiles. So with that out of the way, Lost Memory of Skin follows a young male protagonist known as the Kid, who lives under a causeway in Colusa, which is a fictional city in South Florida. He lives there with a host of other characters who have been convicted of sex crimes. After a police raid that breaks up the community under the causeway and which results in the death of the kid's pet iguana, the kid meets the professor, a giant, fat, Santa Claus-like character who works as an instructor and researcher of sociology at a local college. The professor proceeds to take the kid under his wing, ostensibly to research the causes of homelessness among sex criminals, but also to prove his theory that pedophilia can be cured. As the relationship between the kid and the professor develops, the reader learns what happened to the kid that brought him to his current sorry state. And we may or may not learn about what the professor did in his youth as a minor government spy. I say may or may not learn because as the novel closes up, there is some real doubt and questioning about whether or not the professor is who he says he is, if he was a spy or if he's simply a pathological liar or a weirdo or, in the terms of this novel, a chomo, a child molester. So there's a lot of questions surrounding the professor and who he really is. Eventually, the professor either gets murdered or commits suicide. We're not sure which, but the kid comes away from his relationship with the professor feeling much stronger, willing to take responsibility for his crime, becoming hopeful that he'll be able to take care of himself and eventually re-enter society. And ultimately, he chooses to believe that the professor was not a child molester, that he was murdered for being a spy, and that he was not a liar or anything like that. So that's the quick and dirty rundown of what happens in the novel. Anything I should add, guys?
No, that seems like a pretty thorough synopsis to me.
Okay, cool. So, I have a number of questions, and I'm wondering where to start. Let's talk about let's talk about the ranking of the moral ranking that the sex crime convicts under the causeway kind of to do to one another. So they rank one another according to their crimes. So like the kid, we learn in the novel, is guilty of trying to meet a teenage girl for sex. And then, so he's ranked higher than a guy the kid calls the Shyster, whose real name is Lawrence Somerset, and who was a congressperson or a high-profile lawyer who tried to have sex with two prepubescent girls. So, like, they rank one another, all the members. So, like, basically the difference seems to be, like, puberty, basically. So, like, if you have tried to have sex with someone who is post-pubescent, then you are not as horrible as someone who tried to have sex with people who were prepubescent. And I think this is definitely a real thing that people convicted of sex crimes do. I think this is a real thing that they really do. But I'm wondering, is this here just for realism, or does this offer like a hint at a thematic issue in the novel?
I'll say that I think that there's maybe we can get to it from the place where the kid apparently ends up, because, and this is a bit of more of a dramatic arc than a thematic one, but I think that it's attached to some of the thematic issues in the novel, so maybe it'll unlock that.
Sure.
At the end of the novel, the kid returns to the causeway and appears to be in a position of sort of embracing his past without condoning it, which is an interesting elevated place from right. where he had been before. And he's also briefly convinced that the professor, who he didn't always trust, but he admired quite a bit, I think, at times, was actually a child molester who had been engaged in email conversations with the Shyster, with the child molester that you mentioned before.
He's suspicious that
he's suspicious of that, or convinced in a kind of childlike way right. of that is true, and he learns from the Shyster, through confronting the Shyster and basically kind of throwing the Shyster's crimes in the Shyster's face. So basically taking advantage of that ranking that you described
right.
to shit on the Shyster,
right.
which sounds like a pun, but I don't mean for it to be one.
It's good.
And though. It is good. And he feels guilty after that. And he resolves, after learning from the Shyster, that the actual, you know, other person in these emails wasn't the professor, was someone who has been dead for a couple of years now.
Right.
He resolves to not do that again. And so there is, like, the ranking that you describe is something that the kid is sort of proud of. He's proud of not being a child molester. He's proud of right. not being, and he's, you know, pretty judgmental, which I think it's important to say, like, it's hard to talk about these things without being judgmental. Like, I think it's pretty reasonable for us to kind of, like, venture into judgment when we're talking about these things, because they are so scarring and awful and right. And difficult emotionally and harsh morally. So it's not, you know, it's the kid being judgmental about, you know, these other, you know, sex offenders around him is, and his place in this pecking order is not really that profound, I guess. But at the end, he does reach a point where it seems as though he is not going to, it seems, take advantage of that ranking, of that sort of, He's not going to just hate people for, or despise or be disgusted, and if he's going to resolve to not do these things. simply because of their past. There's something that happens to him at the end. So I don't know if that gets at the thematic that you were asking about. I think that it's more of a dramatic arc for the kid.
Right.
But I think that it does sort of speak to, maybe it's getting at that, this really sticky wicket, this really sticky moral wicket in this novel, which is these people did things that are unforgivable. And yet it is the human, and the novel has some, has some Christian aspects to it too, you know, hints of them. It's the human thing to do to basically not isolate or hold people in a place of permanent purgatory where they have no opportunity to seek absolution or to move on. Like, that's not empathetic. That's not constructive. And yet we struggle specifically with sex crimes, and especially sex crimes against minors or children, to reconcile that with the fact that, like, what these people did is unforgivable. So how do we get to that place of forgiveness? And so, I don't know. The kid seems to kind of find his own Lagrange point between those two kind of mutually exclusive poles at the end.
I think the ending is very interesting in that regard, because, like, and maybe you guys will disagree with me on this, but it seems like for most of the novel, our sense is that what has happened to the kid is perhaps not fair, right? Not the product right. of what you would expect in a just society, right? Like, this is someone who was severely neglected as a child, was not given any kind of affection, was not given any opportunity to develop what seemed to be natural talents that he has, and essentially ended up severely addicted to porn, and with a very severely addicted to porn, incredibly insecure, with a very warped understanding of sex and sexuality, and acted based on that, right? I mean, there are very strong right. suggestions that social forces have turned the kid into someone who would do what he did, and it's difficult to, you know, I mean, the nature of fiction is such that you come to understand an individual, and it's always harder to judge individuals by blanket rules, right?
Right.
There's a very draconian set of rules, a very draconian set of laws and punishments that applies to this whole group of people equally. And the more that we understand this nuanced individual, the harder it is to support that, right?
Right.
But in spite of that, in spite of the fact that 99% of the text seems to inspire in us the sense that this is not fair or just, and this person is not experiencing what he should in a just society, the outcome for him as a character is still that the only way to move forward is to accept guilt, to stop pushing back against the sense of unfairness, and to basically serve out his sentence under the causeway and just wait 9 years until he can reenter society, right? It's almost like the kind of the whole set of laws around sex offense are almost like a force of nature for the kid, right? They're not something that can right. be fought or pushed back against. And ultimately, even if they are not fair, the only appropriate way to live in the world, or the only possible way to live in the world, becomes to accept them and to behave on the terms that you are given. And so the ranking, part of what the ranking does is, getting back to your initial question of the ranking, which I think we're kind of still tied to, right? The part of yeah. what the ranking does is allow the kid to bypass a sense of responsibility. It allows the kid to have in some part of his heart the suggestion that the punishment is not fair, because what he has done is not nearly as bad as what the Shyster has done, but the Shyster and he are in the same prison.
Right.
And I think that he has to let go of that to accept the world as it has been given to him, even though we and he understand that on some level the world as it has been given to him is not fair. And I think that's very interesting. I don't know if it's a contradiction within the world of the novel or if it's maybe just the only kind of possible version of a happy ending that character can have.
Right. Yeah, I agree. That is like a super interesting ending, given that most of the novel we do feel like, you know, like the kid has been a victim, right? And
right.
If on one occasion, one single occasion, he, you know, intended to commit a sex crime, there are all these factors that seem to have made it, well, I mean, maybe not made it determined or anything, but certainly seem to have mitigated some of his guilt, a fair bit of his guilt. And then at the end, you know, he accepts this guilt that he probably doesn't really deserve, because there's no other choice. So I realize I just totally repeated what you said, Hans, but, you know,
that's how I know I made a good point.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause there's nothing extra to say. So that's pretty interesting.
It's, I mean, but that's, and I think that's tough. This isn't really addressed in the text of the novel, but I think like you can extrapolate to it pretty easily, right? Like it's, we know the kid's individual circumstance. And so we come to that place of compassion and understanding. And we feel as readers that in a truly just society, every individual who's convicted of some type of crime like this will have, you know, like if there were enough resources and the right kind of understanding, there are things that could be done for the kid that would allow him to develop in such a way that he would never do anything like what he did again, right?
Right.
Because he would be in a position of strength and power.
And so does that...
his crime ultimately came from desperation and weakness, right? He did what he did because he was desperate and weak and alone. And if he is empowered, he will not do that again. But the thing is that, like, ultimately, stereotypically at least, and I don't know how backed this is by, like, scientific research, right? But, like, there's an idea that almost all of these kinds of, like, sex crimes, they tend to be cyclical, done by people who had that offense done to them as children, right?
Right.
That a great number of offenders are, in fact, victims. And the nature of the crime is such that, like, the boundary between victim and offender, many, many people who are offenders are... or victimizers were victims at some point in their lives. And how do you design a law or a moral code around that, right? And I mean, right. I think that question is implied in the novel, even if it's not stated explicitly.
Sure, absolutely.
Presumably, if we knew enough about the Shyster, we might not come to the same level of sympathy we have for the kid, because his case might be egregiously unfair in a way that the Shyster's is not. But there's always things that we can know about a person's perspective that can soften the judgment that we have.
Right,
and I
right,
think
right. Yeah.
The kid letting go of that sense of hierarchy at the end is a way of acknowledging that, probably.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. So this, like, this kind of makes me think about another question that I had, which is, like, what the relationship of the overall novel is to the professor's belief system. So the professor believes that human behavior is best understood as the outcome of social forces and relationships. Like, this is what causes human behavior. And this belief is probably responsible for his feeling that he can cure pedophilia, right? Like, he can cure these people because he believes all we have to do is change their social situation, right? So given what we've said about the ranking and the dramatic arc that Chris mentioned, do we think that essentially the novel holds this same position as well? Like, is the professor just a stand-in for what the novel says? Or is it more like we're just supposed to wonder?
I think it's... So there's this is maybe a wrinkle that doesn't, like, build to any particular direction, but one of the sort of insights that the kid has after the professor has died, either killing himself and making it look like it was sort of a complicated way of killing himself to imply that he had been assassinated,
right,
or actually been assassinated in a way that was sort of sloppy in its attempt to make him look like he had killed himself. And the professor is like a true cipher. Like, the professor is like one of the most amazing characters. I fucking love the professor.
Yeah, he's great.
He's awesome. Incredible.
The kid and the professor make a really good duo too.
Like, yeah. Oh yeah. They're great. Really the kid. Really yeah. The kid is kind of sharp tongued and sharp, like, smart. Sort of zigzaggy in his thoughts, and then the professor is sort of glacial and ponderous, but like seemingly all-knowing, almost right. Like at times, like, you know, there's times early in the novel where it almost feels like he's like, I don't know, like not a real human being. But the professor's death leads the kid to conjecture about, you know, how we die, sort of like cementing our legacy, or like a kind of like a final sort of like, a thing we can do to sort of like signal to the world what we are. And so I feel like there's a hint there at the relationship between, you know, the world telling us who we are and us telling the world what we are, that is sort of more complicated and give and take than what the professor would like to sort of suggest. Like, I think the professor is a little bit neat and tidy all the time. Everything, every question has an answer. Every process is there to be understood. He has a kind of robotic control over himself that breaks at one point, and we glimpse something like really kind of broken and messy underneath. And I think that his idea of like basically social forces shaping us, and then, you know, taking those social forces and like simply sort of like manipulating them in a way to kind of like promote good behavior, and that being the answer to everything, is actually sort of naive in a way. I think that there's something in how, in our agency, that makes that a very narrow and untrue way of sort of seeing how we function in the world and how we're shaped by it.
So that's what you think the novel suggests?
I think so. I think how the novel captures the professor's the professor's competence is, and I don't know if I can support this with any, I can't support it with any specific line, but to me, the professor's competence is so self-aggrandizing that I can't trust it.
Mm.
I feel like his competence belies a very fundamental, like, misunderstanding of how things function. Like, he sets up helps Kid and the convicts under the causeway set up this shelter that they're going to turn into something more permanent, and it's going to be clean, and it can be someplace where they can all stay. And they live in fucking Florida, where, like, a hurricane comes and just destroys all of it. And it was a stupid idea. Like, it's a profoundly dumb idea to take, you know, basically this encampment that has, like, no support structures and instantiate it even more permanently, you know, a few feet off of the ocean. It's dumb. And so there's a kind of a dumbness to him that I don't know if I can really encompass, but
I had not thought about it that way. That's interesting, though.
Is it a stupid idea? Or is it just, I mean, lots and lots of buildings get ruined by storms. That doesn't mean it's a dumb idea to have buildings, you know? Did Hurricane Katrina prove that the whole existence of New Orleans was a stupid idea? I don't know.
It might.
I mean... It would be easier to perceive it as a stupid idea if the ultimate resolution of the Ark of the Kid wasn't to go back under the causeway and buy a new generator, right? The storm is kind of like, the storm is almost like the sex offender rules, right? Like, the storm, the sex offender rules are this thing that is probably not fair and that doesn't distinguish between people at the level of nuance that it should. But ultimately, the only resolution to the arc of the kid is to accept and do your best, right? Accept the world as it's been put upon you and do your best. And the storm is very much like the kind of sex offender laws in that regard, you know, this sort of dumb force of nature that just destroys indiscriminately. But the ultimate decision that they make is to, again, you know, go back down there, buy another generator, do your best, right? And I don't know that, you know, the fact that things beyond our control destroy our plans doesn't mean that planning is worthless necessarily. You know, the storm happened to come when the whole encampment was, what, like a week old? Less than that, right? I mean,
right.
If they had had a year to structure that society, perhaps they could have been more resilient to that storm. I think it's maybe up for debate whether what the professor tried to do was dumb or not. You know, you could argue that there are other reasons that it was dumb, but I think, like, the existence of forces that we can't control doesn't mean that the things that those forces destroy were terrible ideas to begin with. Or maybe it does. I don't know. I mean, maybe it is. Maybe having a city that is protected by, you know, having a city that will be destroyed if the levees break is a dumb idea, given the, you know, chaotic nature of humanity being such that inevitably the levees won't always be cared for the way they should, or whatever. But the other thing that I was thinking, though, is, like, to your question, to your point about, like, the professor's idea of changing social forces to create a better outcome for human behavior, I suppose that ultimately the professor's own fate maybe reveals the limits of that, right? Like, the professor is a manipulator. The professor manipulates the world and the people in the world and does so in a very confident way. and at some point that comes undone, right? And I suppose the limits of what the professor can do as a manipulator of his own life perhaps suggests the limits of what can be done through what seems to essentially be a large-scale form of social manipulation, right? Like, if the professor's idea is, like, how do we change social practices to make people do what we want them to do, if the professor can't do some version of that in the management of his own life, perhaps it is naive to think that some version of that can be done in the management of human society. But... And maybe the two points that I'm making contradict each other to some extent, right? Maybe thematically the question of whether the initial settlement is dumb or not is very tied to the question of whether the professor's ideas about manipulating human behavior are practical or not. I don't know if the novel has a stance on that. I mean, it does seem like things could have been done. It does seem like things could have been done which would have resulted in the kid turning out better than he did, right? I mean, there are, you know... And it does also seem like the encounter with the professor has changed the kid for the better, ultimately. Perhaps not in the way that the professor intended, but it does seem like he has emerged as a stronger person from that relationship.
Right.
And I think we probably, everyone in this podcast would sort of agree that social structures and like how our society functions has a massive effect on, you know, the relative happiness and success of people and is wildly unfair in the people that it damns and the people that it lifts up, and the encampment under the causeway of people basically sort of exiled to this purgatory where they can never move beyond what they've done or, you know, develop as you know, new law-abiding citizens is obviously a stupid way of doing this, and doesn't really benefit everyone or anyone. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. But I think the question is kind of the limits of control, the amount of sort of agency that someone like the professor, who has, you know, who hints at, and the novel seems to support, a kind of almost limitless like level of competence that, again, I don't entirely trust because of like the seemingly limitless nature of it. Even with that competence, it's not possible to control for everything or to really guarantee a cure for something like pedophilia or other sex offenses. And I think it's one thing that does sort of also potentially set someone like the kid aside, maybe from someone like Shyster. The kid is savable, and we know that. And I think, you know, whether or not the professor is actually a savior or a monster is kind of the question of whether or not, you know, someone like the Shyster is actually someone who deserves any pity at all, or is actually, you know, unforgivable.
Well, and I suppose the professor's position is more one of utility than pity, right? If you say that... If your goal is to eliminate sex crimes in the world, then, and your goal is to eliminate that by eliminating root causes rather than just, you know, by taking every sex criminal and essentially excising them fully from society, If your goal is to eliminate sex crimes in the world and you wish to achieve that by eliminating root causes, then understanding someone like the Shyster is inevitably a valuable way to do that. And there's a difference, I suppose, conceptually between understanding which comes from compassion and understanding which comes from the utilitarian need to try to shape behavior, right? But in some ways, they may look very similar. The professor is not interested in the kid because he feels compassion. The professor is interested in the kid out of the utilitarian desire to change larger scale social forces for what he sees to be a positive result. But the things that he does for the kid are nevertheless similar to what would be done out of compassion, I think. And I don't know, maybe that's a, I don't know how much value there is to the question of that distinction, but to the question of can you have compassion for somebody like the Shyster? Perhaps not, but you can behave in ways that are not too different from how you would behave if you were compassionate, if you are simply trying to understand for the sake of improving a larger social force.
Interesting. That doesn't, you know, all this talk of the professor, we should probably address, like, the, like, what we make of him. So I originally asked a question on my sheet that was kind of wonky, and I'm just gonna like scrap that question and ask something a little bit better, hopefully. And that is, like, so we're talking a lot about the professor. We're wondering, you know, like, you know, we're saying certainly things about him that are true, like he doesn't feel compassion. He just wants to, in, you know, cure pedophilia, which to me seems like a pretty good goal, regardless of whether he feels compassion or not. You know, that, like, that seems like a moral improvement in the world. But Chris, you know, you're doubtful that he's has the competence that he seems to display. So there are a lot of potential readings of the professor. So what do we think? Where do we lean about his story? So do we think that he is a former spy who worked for the government and who is now a sociology professor / genius trying to, you know, cure pedophilia? Or is he, well, he could be a sociology professor either way, but do we think he was once a spy and was murdered? Or do we think that something else is going on in his past that he kills himself for? And why is it important one way or the other what we believe?
I don't know if it is important for us to believe it one way or the other. Let me start again. I'll start where I do think it's important. I think it's important for the kid to believe that the professor wasn't a, you know, a child molesting monster and was in fact a kind of almost unicorn of competency and intelligence crossed with, you know, weird pathological ills. Like he is a compulsive eater.
Yeah.
Those scenes that describe his eating are so incredible. Good. They're amazing.
Yeah.
And he's a giant, deeply unhealthy man who has a very fraught, you know, relationship with his wife that is, I think, warm, but not very honest and open. And he's the kind of the border between his sort of benevolence and compassion. So I'm going to distinguish between benevolence, which feels more like a sort of like a deity's benevolence, and a mortal human's compassion.
Right.
Like, I think it's hard to tell whether he's benevolent or compassionate. You know, he feels very superior to the people around him in a way that almost kind of is irritating or even like hair raising. And, you know, or just like frustrating. So I don't necessarily doubt his competence. He's obviously extremely like intelligent. But he is a liar. I mean, he lies about the, map, the treasure map.
Right.
And then he provides a very weird sort of explanation for why he made that lie about the treasure map, which is to test the kid's imagination. And all of these things are sort of like, they become kind of reasons for themselves where, you know, the kid comes away believing that the professor never said anything or did anything without having a reason for doing it. And that too feels kind of unrealistic to me. Like, that feels like something the professor would want to sort of like have other people believe about him.
Right.
And those things become self-reinforcing though, where like, you know, you kind of like just, you know, do enough weird shit and people like sort of start looking for meaning in that weird shit. And, you know, if you're smart enough, maybe you make it so that even the things that you do on instinct or without reason look like they've been done for a reason. And that, I think it's important for the kid to believe that the professor is this, you know, bigger than life, you know, person because of what that allows the kid to sort of like move forward to and in his life. And I don't know if it's important for us as the readers to believe either way. Maybe it's more important for us to recognize the kid's need to believe that than it is for us to know. I'm just inherently skeptical of conspiracy theories, I guess. I don't really think that it is. The conspiracy theory would be that, you know, there is kind of like a mechanism or there's systematic elimination of like citizens of the United States.
You don't think that
to
happens?
Protect. No, I don't actually.
You,
I guess
you
like
don't think that the U.S. government has never killed a spy that has gone rogue or something like that.
I don't think that the U.S. government has killed a spy living in Florida as a sociology professor with like a wife and two kids. It's not like he's gone rogue. Like the concept of him, like he doesn't even like, so the thing too is like, we keep on saying like, is he a sex offender? You know, I don't know. Like the thing is, we don't really know like what the story that would be coming out about him is anyway.
Right.
So I don't know. Like I just, the thing that I come back to is that I don't know. I guess I'm mostly comfortable not knowing.
Sure.
I'm very comfortable and, I approve of the kid's need to believe. I get that. I think that that makes sense.
So on that reading, where we don't really need to know for sure, we just need to believe one way or the other, the like one thematic statement the novel might be making would be similar to something that the writer says, the guy that comes up later in the novel to and who is doing a piece on the Pensacola Swamp, I think. And like he and the kid kind of have some conversations after the professor's death. And, you know, the writer says, you know, you can't really know anything, so you just choose something to believe so that you can act. Which is, you know, very postmodern of him, and he says he's educated at Brown, so very educated of him to say, which I find interesting. But so we would take that statement as a pretty straightforward statement that the novel agrees with, right? If what you're saying is true, Chris.
I think the novel agrees with it in the context of the kid's decision in that moment.
Right. Maybe not like larger.
I think at some point you can't, you know, you have to accept some responsibility for the investigation of the truth. And you can't, I mean, if you casually treat everything that way, that eventually becomes a very nihilistic standpoint.
Right.
But there are times when you have to acknowledge, that certain things are unknowable, and it's ultimately more beneficial to take some kind of point and act on it with at least some amount of self-awareness that that's what you're doing.
So like the statement the novel makes is more limited than I implied when I just was speaking.
Well, I mean, my instinct is to say it's probably more limited than you're implying, because it is ultimately, it's a novel which honors the particularity of individual circumstance, right?
Right.
It's very interested in the particularity of individual circumstance. And so I don't know that. I mean, I think it feels more in line with the general kind of aesthetic of the novel to particularize it to that and to not say that is somehow also like a guide to how to think about, I don't know, climate change or something, right?
Right. Yeah, definitely. I do think it's interesting, though, Chris, you said something earlier. Like, you are doubtful that the professor is as competent as he makes himself out to be, right?
Yeah, I guess I'm doubtful. It's competence, I think, is a hard word. I'm doubtful that the professor is as conscious of all of his actions and intentional in them and their target outcomes as he would like other people to believe he is, and to some extent as he would like to believe he is,
right?
If that makes sense.
Sure.
I guess that boils down to competence. I think like competence is hard to like, it's less specific. I think specifically he wants to be seen as someone with profound control over himself, and through that profound control over himself and his broad competence, control over his situation. And I don't think that he is as in control as he would like to believe or as he would like other people to believe.
Yeah, that I find that really interesting, because that stance definitely has some effect on how we read the professor's death. So the kid has this thought that if if the professor committed suicide, then the bike locks that he used, like, were a really good way to throw people off, right? Because it's not, they're not chains. They're not like real chains, which I guess the kid believes like a government agency would have used chains or something stronger. So like it throws a lot of doubt on, but the bike locks throw a lot of doubt into the issue, and we're not able to understand whether he killed himself or whether he was murdered. But if he is super competent and is, you know, a way, like basically this puppeteer, then the bike lock kind of supports that idea. So if you doubt that he's as competent as he wants to believe that he is, then the ending seems more like he was murdered.
I find that whole conjecture by the kid to be sort of like unsubstantiable, like,
sure,
like Calvin Ball, you know, like I think of, like, when I said before that the professor is potentially more interested in projecting the sense of control, that's what that sense of control leads you to kind of consider.
Right.
Are all these, like, little decisions when, I don't know, he just had some bike locks, or there's easier to get bike locks.
Right.
Like, and it's
right.
Like the, I think that is, to me, and this is like, again, I think it's my own sort of, potentially my own lens on this book. I don't know if the book is actually like encouraging me to read it this way. I feel like the case that I would make for the book intending for me to read it this way is something that's hard to sort of nail down, which is, again, kind of the limits of control. Maybe like throughout the novel, we kind of see or are given more hints at like the professor's kind of bullshit. Like there's a couple things, like he names like a particular kind of response, like a autonomic response that a dog has when like you touch the dog in a certain way, and it's like I kind of want to look that shit up, but I don't really have, I just didn't do it. So I kind of wonder if there's more bullshit, like,
right?
And I think the kid's conjecture about that is more almost like a dramatic irony space potentially for us to sort of like potentially occupy if we are as skeptical as I am of these types of things.
Right.
And where I think like whether or not, it's sort of like the kid recognizing the professor's voice in those emails, that's pretty naive.
Right,
like that's,
yeah.
Whether or not they're chains or bicycle locks, the writer engaging with him in this conversation about that is to me is kind of like, I lose a little bit of respect for the writer. I don't know. I that to me is interesting, but I don't know what to do with it beyond sort of think of it as something that is evidence of what we do with sort of the details of a story that we don't understand when we're trying to sort of understand somebody.
Yeah.
And that overlaps a bit with the nature of conspiracy theories, right? Because one aspect of conspiracy theorizing is the attribution of design and intention to every detail, right?
Right.
Much of which might just be a question of, you know, chance or fate,
right,
or availability, right? And so, you know, what the kid is doing there in assigning meaning to the choice of a bike lock rather than a chain, it like you said, Chris, it becomes a way of kind of conjecturing from a desired outcome, right? And I suppose if the professor has, one of the professor's talents is probably that he has managed to create this aura of hypercompetence where he is encouraging the kid to do things like conjecture backward in encouraging the kid to assign meaning to detail, to assign design and intention to detail that is very likely accidental, in the same way that we would assign that to, you know, a shadowy government agency that we perceive as hypercompetent, right? It's right. The perception of, the cultivated perception of hypercompetence then leads to everything being read within that, everything being read through that lens, which becomes kind of a self-reinforcing, self-fulfilling or self-reinforcing prophecy.
So, just to kind of wrap everything up, since we're running out of time, I just wanted to say that this is the second time I've read this novel. I remember enjoying it, really enjoying it the first time, and I really enjoyed it this time. Like, it's just a really good, I love the voice of the novel. It's very, It reminds me of Orwell a little bit, in that it's very blasé almost, if that's the right.
That's a good connection. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, yeah. If that room, you know, it's very breezy, and that was the word you used, Chris, when we talked about Coming Up for Air several months back. But you know, the voice is really excellent, and like on a reread, it's. Like the issues are deep in this novel, and it's really hard. Like it's not as much of a puzzle box as some other things, like The Golem, but it's definitely like you got to tease some things out to really get what it's going for, I think. And like the professor is a case in point. I remember when I first read it, really coming away with the feeling that the professor was not a sex criminal, that he had been a spy. And on the second read, I come away feeling like it's not important. Like it's stupid even to speculate. Like not stupid, but it's not. The point is not, we shouldn't be speculating. We should just, you know, realize that some things are unknowable. Not everything is unknowable. Like obviously that's not, you know, a position that the novel holds. Otherwise, you know, why would it, you know, there's lots of things that seem to be able to be known in the novel, but certainly the professor's ultimate personality and past is unknowable. And that's like a difference that I had on this reading. Still really loved the kid and felt like things that, like you said, Hans, that, you know, shit had been unfair to him, you know, like he had seen some real adversity. So that's my ultimate take. Really enjoyable book. I know that we're taking a longer break between our next podcast. So, Chris, did you have a book picked out that you wanted us to read for next time? Or are we waiting since we're taking a bit of a bigger break? What are we doing there?
Let me take a few days and pick something out.
Okay.
But I'll let you know in the next few days. And I just wanted to weigh in and say, I really, really love this book.
It's real good.
Lost Memory of Skin is incredible. It's really hard, I imagine, for some people to engage with this topic. But I think it's important to say, if you're listening to this episode and you haven't read the book, that's pretty profound. But if you haven't read the book, Banks is not condoning any of this,
right? Yeah,
or you know, and the book does a really, really strenuous, earned job of finding a place to really like litigate something that's very difficult to even sort of like discuss. And it's really, really smart and really, really affecting. And even just, like you said, breezy and fun. Yeah.
You have any final thoughts, Hans?
Well, I'm pretty much just going to echo what you guys have said. I'm a big admirer of this book. I mean, it's, when I think about like what I understand to be the value, the distinct and unique value of literary fiction as an art form, right? Meaning prose fiction, which is concerned with the exploration of philosophical and social questions. This is it, right?
Yeah, like
this
is, it really is.
If why do we want this form to continue to exist as a art form in the world? It's this, you know.
Yeah.
And I suppose that you could, I mean, you could maybe make like a, you know, 8-episode television miniseries that told this story, maybe with the same amount of texture and empathy, but no one would ever do that. You know,
right.
that mm-hmm. is not a thing that could exist in the kind of artistic market climate that we have. And this does. And I'm very glad that it does.
Awesome. Okay, listeners, you'll have to be in a little suspense for our next episode, since we don't know what we're reading next. But I hope you've been
Harry Potter.
Oh yeah, that fucking turf. So I hope you've enjoyed our discussion of Lost Memory of Skin, and I hope you tune in to our next episode when it becomes available. Peace out, everyone.